I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Stanley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:08, Wednesday, March 10th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And since this episode is sure to turn into a John Green back padding session, allow me to introduce you to my little friend.
Yay! All right, Joe. Very nice.
I am Bill.
Congratulations.
For the Thoroughbred Daily News. And I can't wait to just drill John on how we can have a fantasy draft. He picks his horses, doesn't pick his own horse, who goes on to win the Tampa Bay Derby and is now, you know, it's the rage in all of three-year-old racing. John, what the heck were you thinking?
Well, this is John Green, team manager at DJ Stable, and I love helium.
That's a great touch.
What, was there something wrong?
That was great. That was hilarious. Where did you get a balloon? I don't know where.
I had to go to the supermarket and get a like a child.
Yeah, he stole it from like some 5-year-old girl. He saw.
Give me that kid. I just won the Tampa Bay Derby. Give me that damn balloon.
Oh man.
Bill, the one time you did a really, really long intro and I was like, I kept sucking helium, I started to get faint. I was like,
I think you're blowing lines. I sounded like he was blowing lines. I heard. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Entries are now open for the March digital sale in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. The Keeneland Digital Sales Ring provides a standalone online auction accessible to buyers and sellers around the world. Keeneland is world-renowned for its live auction environment, and this online tool offers the quality experience you expect from Keeneland Sales in an online format. For more information and to enter now, visit KeenelandDigital.com. Okay, so pretty big weekend of racing. We're going to get to the most important result of the weekend. But I guess the most important result of the weekend was John Green and Helium and DJ Stable winning the Tampa Bay Derby.
Thank you.
Digging back gamely is Helium. Looks like we're down to two. Helium repels the challenge. It's Helium in a huge effort. Turns away the challenge of Hidden Stash.
So that was tremendous. Honestly, like I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I think this was a top shelf performance. The buyer figure was only 84, but I would not put too much stock into that because of the way he won the race, because of how wide he had to go on both turns. I didn't see what the Thoroughgraph or Ragazin numbers were, but I'm sure they were pretty big considering the ground loss. This was his first start on dirt. He had only run twice before, both on the Tapita at Woodbine. John's going to give me crap because I was waffling on making him a rising star first time out when he won. But I'm so loath to make those synthetic track horses rising stars. And I thought the runner-up wasn't much. But in retrospect, should have done it because he's now a graded stakes winner. Great training job by Mark Cassie, I got to say, to have him ready off the layoff to run that big of a race. Mark says that maybe he'll pass on another prep until the Derby. I don't know about that one. Mark's a Hall of Famer. He probably knows better than me, but we'll discuss it. First of all, congratulations to John and the whole team. It's a great win. But it was an impressive race to watch because of the ground loss, but then also because halfway through the stretch, you know, the horse who followed his move and got to the outside of him, 9 times out of 10, that horse is going to run by the horse that made the big early move. But Helium dug in and turned him back. And, you know, I thought, you know, other than the buyer figure, which I said, again, is low, I think mostly because of circumstance, I don't think that could have been a much more impressive race for your first start on dirt, first grade stakes start, first start as a 3-year-old. So we'll get to John's thoughts in a second. But Bill, I'm sure John would love to hear some credit from you as well.
Well, I mean, first of all, John, congratulations. And we love to kid around with you, but great job. And we'll see you on the first Saturday in May in the box section at Churchill Downs. So, I mean, you obviously covered Helium, and we'll certainly let John talk more about it. And I am going to ask if he were a guest, he does need to address the should he run again before the Derby? Yes, no to a prep. I'm sure he knows where I stand on that. But again, I'm not certainly not going to tell Mark Cassie and John Green what to do. But I mean, the biggest story, of course, was Life is Good. And, you know, this is a peculiar horse. He wins by 8 lengths and just runs away and hides from the competition. But, you know, what's going on with him in the stretch that he's bearing out like he is? He's out in the middle of the track. And I think a lot of us probably thought the same thing. You know, it reminds us so much of what Authentic did last year. And I was among those that jumped off the Authentic bandwagon. And this horse is following that same pattern. He's winning easily, but looks really green in his starts. But, you know, considering what Baffert did with Authentic, I don't think that anybody should really dismiss this horse for the Kentucky Derby. A matter of fact, that race was so dynamic and so strong that I think now it's fair to say that he has surpassed Essential Quality as the number one candidate for the Kentucky Derby. As Santa Anita, we had Idol winning the Big Cap, a decent horse. It looks like he's coming around. He was third in the San Pasquale before that. I think the bigger story was that Maxfield finished third. And we kept waiting to see what this horse was all about. And I think the jury is now in on him. He's a very, very good horse, but perhaps not a super, superstar like perhaps we had hoped. And then the Gotham, a horse by the name of Wayburn, won and paid $95.50. I never heard of him, and I don't think I'm going to pay much attention to him going forward.
Bill, as usual, you hit all the high points as far as the races go. I think all of us, you know, our fans and people in the industry are kind of looking up at the top couple of horses, whether it's Greatest Honor, Essential Quality, Life is Good. You know, they're just kind of rising to the top of the a very, I think, talented three-year-old group. And I think all the rest of us are kind of on the outside looking in, you know, at those handful of horses that are just, you know, at least from the metrics standpoint, look like they are the ones to beat. And you know, usually you go into a Derby season, this close to Derby season, there's usually a handful of horses that you can make a case for. I think there's a handful of horses that are just outstanding three-year-olds. And they're coming in from California and from Oakland and from Louisiana, and maybe even from Florida. But it's just, to me, studying this group of horses, it just seems like it's a very talented group of three-year-olds as they're entering their final preps for the Derby campaign. And a lot of them, you know, Life is Good included, are just putting up tremendous figures. So, you know, 107 buyer is just outstanding. And you know, I did a little research and listened to a couple of other podcasts, and they were throwing off horses, a handful of horses that were running those kind of numbers. And it was like Fushiashi Pegasus and Medaglia d'Oro and California Chrome come to mind that were running 106, 107 buyers entering the final stage of, you know, pre-Kentucky Derby races. And, you know, this horse may, Life is Good, I'm talking about, may be that talented. And certainly Greatest Honor, Essential Quality, and a couple others also, you know, have earned that mantle. But it's a really good group of three-year-olds, I think, overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think we learned that pretty early on. I mean, Mandaloon is a little forgotten. He ran a 98 in the Risen Star and is probably going to go favored in the Louisiana Derby. And Caddo River is running this Saturday in the Rebel, and we haven't seen him since the Southwest. I got to say, you know, just as an aside, I'm not feeling great about my fantasy team because four of them have run already, and none of them have done anything. So I'm banking all my chips on Caddo River being a total monster because Freedom Fighter was fourth in the Gotham. Dream Shake was third in the San Felipe. The Great One was fifth. And then Jackie's Warrior was third in the Southwest and is probably cutting back. So all my chips are in on Caddo River right now. John did have Life is Good. The thing with Life is Good is I'm never going to be a fan of these type of runoff one-way speed horses. It's just, I think that it all comes crashing down eventually. Now, it didn't mostly for Authentic last year. He was able to carry his speed to wins in the Derby and a Breeders' Cup Classic. And there's a distinct possibility that Life is Good is just too good and just too fast for all of his three-year-old competition. But I just wonder if there's a lot of speed signed on in the Derby and he's going to be a short price. He's 2-1 in the future pool. Who are the people who are taking this horse at 2-1 in the future pool? Like, I don't understand the mindset that goes into betting a horse at 2-1 to win a race that'll have 20 horses in the gate 2 months from now. I would just love to interview one of those people and ask what they were thinking, because he's going to be a short price most likely, especially if he wins the Santa Anita Derby, but he's not going to be that much lower than that. Like he's probably going to be like, even if he blows out in the Santa Anita Derby, he's going to be just like 6-5, 7-5. So you're getting like this much value having to wait 2 months to hope the horse doesn't get hurt or step on a tack or something. Like, I don't understand that. He did get a 107 buyer, which for 3-year-olds in this day and age, this early in the season, is a monster number. Like there's no two ways around it. And that was a good feel that he blew away, at least on paper. And so I can't fault him for the performance. I mean, the thing with the drifting and the stretch is a little worrisome. I think, you know, it reminds me maybe of a little bit of a maximum security situation in the Derby. He might cause some problems for other horses and leave himself, you know, susceptible to a disqualification. But, you know, there's nothing to say other than he's been too fast by far for everybody he's faced so far. But I just don't trust these one-way speed horses who haven't been hooked this early in their career. And until I see someone go with him and him, you know, survive that pace duel and keep going, I'm going to try to bet against him every time. And maybe he'll make me look foolish, but you know, that's just the way I am as a handicapper and as a racing fan. I need to see them eyeball somebody and still keep going, which Authentic eventually did in the Derby with Tizzala. And that's to me where he turned the corner and showed that he was actually a top class horse. Elsewhere on the big cap card, Bill mentioned Idol. You know, it was a fine performance. Like I thought Express Ride hung a little bit. And then Maxfield is just, you know, I don't want to be too harsh because it was first time at 1.25 miles, had to ship across the country, the lightly raced horse, but I think he's the hype is a little bit of far ahead of where he actually is from a talent perspective at this point. And maybe he'll get better, you know, if he can stay healthy through his 4-year-old year, but it's certainly not the performance that people were expecting, I think, in that race. Otherwise, Hit the Road, who made me look foolish in the Thunder Road Stakes. He won his the Grade 1 Kilroy Mile. First Grade 1 win for Dan Blacker, so congratulations to the Blackers. I think we might have Christina on next week with us. Elsewhere at Aqueduct, I don't know, Gotham got a decent buyer. It was a 95 for Weyburn. I thought that was a pretty good stretch battle. They had some good battles. They had Search Results, and the other filly going had Dan in the Busher as well for the entire stretch. I just gotta mention Chateau in the Tom Fool, because here's a horse who did nothing but quit his entire life, just could not stop going to the lead and quitting. And now all of a sudden, Rob Atteris has got him into a graded stakes winner. I'll leave that without comment. But it was a solid weekend of racing. Also, Blackberry Wine somehow won a non-3 lifetime allowance, a horse who appears to have won, I think, maybe 17 or 18 times in his career, finally cleared the non-3 allowance condition. Explain that one to me. But anyway, so it was a strong weekend of racing. I think Life is Good is the main story, but the main story for us on the podcast was Helium. So I want to ask John, like, I feel like we hardly ever get these kind of insights into the thinking of campaigning a top 3-year-old. Mark Cassie suggested after the race that he's not going to run the horse again before the Derby. Now, I think that's a mistake. That's just my opinion. Mark Cassie knows a lot more about training than me. He's only run 3 times. He's only run once on dirt. I get that, you know, he's had these spaced races, so you probably think he runs a little bit better fresh. I just wonder if you're forfeiting a little bit of an experience and a conditioning edge if you wait 2 months to run him in the Derby. So I want to know your thoughts, John, about that and what you're expecting.
Yeah, and I'm pleased to make the formal announcement on our podcast that I sat down with the owners, my parents, and with Mark Cassie, who between our groups have, you know, almost 80 years of experience in the horse industry, and we're going to go an unconventional route and actually bypass the rest of the Kentucky Derby preps and get him ready by running him, by training him, in Florida, between Palmettos and Mark's facility in Ocala, and then ship him up to Churchill Downs approximately 3 weeks before the Kentucky Derby, and, put him right into the Derby right off this Tampa Bay race. And it's an unorthodox decision. It's certainly not one that you can point to history and say that a lot of people have done at all. And you can compare it to maybe 2 recent horses that have done it. Destin, who ran, in the prep 1 and then waited 8 weeks and ran 6th in the Kentucky Derby. And people are pointing to King Guillermo and saying that, you know, he won the Tampa Bay Derby as well, and then waited until, you know, the Kentucky Derby to run again. And unfortunately, they canceled the Kentucky Derby. So it's kind of an unknown as to what he would have done in the Derby. But he did run, King Guillermo did run from Tampa the first weekend of May and ran in the Arkansas Derby and ran second in the Arkansas Derby. So it's not unreasonable in history to ask a horse to give a horse 8 weeks and then expect them to run, you know, in a big race like this. Is it perfect? Not perfect. Not perfect. No question about it. Are there risks? Absolutely. And we can take criticism if it doesn't work out. But we just feel like that what's best for the horse is to give him the time and basically slowly peak him into the Kentucky Derby, which is our number one consideration, and bypass, you know, running in fill in the blank, the bluegrass, the race in New York, the race in Arkansas Derby. We could run him in any of those, but then we don't know what we have at that point, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later to run in the Kentucky Derby. And our primary goals for this horse are to run him in the Kentucky Derby and to run him in the Haskell if he's good enough. And obviously there'll be a race in between. But those are our goals. Our goals are not to run him in the bluegrass. Our goals are not to necessarily run him in a race, you know, of that ilk coming up for a lot of reasons, but primarily because we just don't think he needs it right now. And more importantly, he's earned his place in the Kentucky Derby. So there's so many things that can go wrong, you know, between now and running him in another race and then trying to ratchet him back up and peaking him again in the Kentucky Derby, that our main goal is to run him in the Derby and then races afterwards. Whereas a lot of people right now are trying to pad their stats and their resume by running in some Kentucky Derby preps, run their horse in the Derby, maybe one of the other Triple Crown races, and then giving their time off with their horse time off. We're looking at it through a different prism of saying, we're going to run him in the Derby and then continue to run him afterwards when a lot of these horses are already chewed up and spit out.
Go ahead, Bill, cook him, fry him.
Well. John, I mean, again, I have mixed feelings here because, I mean, just like Joe said, I mean, who are Joe and I to question a Hall of Fame trainer, Mark Cassie? But, you know, I this doesn't surprise you, but I think it's the wrong thing to do. And the one thing about it, too, is I think people are so Derby-centric these days that they lose sight of the importance of races like the Wood Memorial, which is the obvious spot for him after winning the Tampa Bay Derby. With all due respect to the horse and Mark Cassie, he's going to be 50-1 in the Kentucky Derby, maybe 40-1, something like that, and probably won't win. That's not a knock on the horse, but just talking about the circumstances that he's in. And wouldn't it be a career maker to win the Wood Memorial? I know it's not a grade one anymore, so it's not going to have a huge effect on the stallion value, but it's going to have a more of effect in winning the Tampa Bay Derby. And I just think, I mean, it's, you know, Derby mania is run so deep that I think people just forget about everything else that matters in this sport. And, you know, whether or not that would be my main, if I were the owner, I was talking to Mark Cassie, that would be my main complaint, you know, going off the 8 weeks rest, whatever, but why should I pass on a chance to win the Bluegrass Arkansas Derby, Wood Memorial? I think the Wood Memorial is where you would wind up. When those are such important races, huge money involved and a lot of prestige involved.
Bill, and you're right. And I think if the horse was a son of Tappet or Into Mischief or even Distorted Humor, okay, where you thought building a stallion resume is of paramount interest because every time he gets a G2 next to his name, or more importantly, a named race like the Bluegrass or the Wood or the Arkansas Derby, you know, that would, you know, increase his value as a stallion prospect. He is by a first year stallion that is not popular, Ironicus. Who really is a turf, you know, was a turf horse himself. And, you know, what the horse is doing is beyond expectations for based on at least the sire line for, you know, for the breeding. So we have, I guess, the luxury of not worrying about prestige for him because he's probably not going to be a stallion prospect unless he does win the Derby or the Haskell or a grade one like that. It's not really going to impress people, you know, who are breeders to want to bring their mares to him based on that. He won the Tampa Bay Derby, which we forget is a grade two, which in comparison, and I know we talk about it all the time about how messed up graded, you know, rankings are right now, but the grade two Tampa Bay Derby is exactly the same grade as the grade two Bluegrass and as the Grade 2 wood memorial. So from a you know, G2 standpoint, they're all equal. And he's already done that. So again, we kind of feel like that we're looking at it as the horse is basically, in basketball terms, has got a double bye in the NCAA tournament. And do we want to go ahead and play Navy in the first round and then, you know, a 12 seed in the second round when we could lose or stub our toe or get injured, when we don't have to? And we don't have to. So why not take advantage of that, you know, based on the on all the scenarios that are in place? You know, when Mark first, you know, sent out the trial balloon, no pun intended, about bypassing these other races and going right into the Derby, I was a little taken aback. Honestly, I was like, wait, that's not conventional thinking. We have to run him again. He ran an 84 buyer. His sheet numbers are okay. And there's no way that he is as good as the top three or four horses that are in the, you know, in the three-year-old group right now based on his current numbers. Just, I mean, the eye test says he is, but all the other metrics say he's not. So we have to improve him 20% basically in order to be, you know, in the conversation. And the more that we looked at it, the more we realized that, you know, Mark has graded stake winners in his stable that are training at Palmettos and at his farm. And if we want to really train Helium against the best of the best, we can do that in our own home track. And yeah, we're not getting paid for it, but it's all under our own conditions and our own circumstances. And we can kind of control the script on him by doing it that way. It's not conventional, but we have to improve this horse 20 to 25%. And we just feel like that we have the best chance of doing that at home, giving him time and then campaigning him hard after the Derby, you know, from the Derby on, when all these other horses are getting chewed up and spit out and all these other preps. So it's not the way that history would say we should do it. And a lot of people have come on both sides and said, he's, you know, superstar, give him the time he can. And also you're never going to accomplish this. Unfortunately, when it comes to the Derby, you can point to the program and say that about 19 of the 20 horses and say that horse isn't going to win that horse because there's only one winner. But we just feel like that based on the current circumstances, this is the best thing to do for the horse. And I'm glad to announce it on our podcast.
All right, so two follow-up questions before we move on. One, since you said, you know, he's not going to be a super popular stallion prospect unless he wins a race like the Derby, would you plan on running him beyond his three-year-old year?
I think you'd have to. I think you'd have to take that into consideration. If he stays sound, then I know where you're going with this, Joe. You're exactly right. Like we foresee if he stays sound, we would love to campaign him for as long as he can. And it's funny when you read, and I'll let you do your second question. When you read some of the comments on, you know, on Twitter and after articles and stuff like that, you know, there's a lot of people who were saying, oh, he's not sound. That's why they want to give him time between races and everything like that. That could be the furthest thing from the truth. And case in point, we just did an insurance exam on him to raise his insurance after he won the Grade 2. And when I tell you that was the most scrutinizing vet report that I've ever seen, he had to go through, you know, tests and exercises that you don't have to do a two-year-old in training sales because now he's a seven-figure insurance, you know, insurable asset. Believe me when I tell you that they put him through the ringer in order to make sure that he was 100% sound.
All right. And then the second question is, are you going to keep Jose Ferreira aboard?
That's a great question. So Jose did a great job on him and won the Tampa Bay Derby with him. And I think it was the first graded stake race he had won in almost a decade. But we are looking for other options with jockeys, not because we don't have confidence in Jose, but for the same reason why we used Jose in Tampa Bay is the same reason why we would use maybe a different rider in the Kentucky Derby. And that's because you have to have somebody who has the experience at Churchill Downs and the experience in those big races. So we haven't made a definitive decision on that, but you know, I would say that we're probably going to look for other opportunities when it comes to riders. And it's no disrespect to Jose. I think he did exactly what we asked him to do on the horse. And it was a great story when he won on the horse. But I would think that we are going to entertain other opportunities.
All right. So we've interrogated you, but just once again, want to say congratulations, John. We really are happy for you guys.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate, Bill, you being soft on me. I mean, that was
wasn't even it. John. It really wasn't.
But I will say one other thing, and this is with all sincerity, and you guys know that I like to joke around, but this is serious. After the horse hit the wire, the first four emails texts and calls that I got were all from people with Thoroughbred Daily News. And that meant so much to me that you two guys and other people at the Thoroughbred Daily News were the very first people to reach out to me when the horse hit the wire. It was exciting and it was exhilarating, but it was really, really cool to be able to share it with you guys, my friends. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So we've been waiting for this shoe to drop, for this domino to fall. Yesterday, 1 year to the day from when the FBI indictments dropped last year, we had our first sentencing. We had the judge handed down 18 months in federal prison to Scott Robinson, who was one of the manufacturers and distributors. You don't have to say allegedly anymore. Yes, I don't have to say allegedly there. All right, so he was a manufacturer and distributor of PEDs. He got 18 months in jail, which seems like a fair enough sentence. It says the bill had a story on it yesterday that was well done. It says the maximum sentence for that offense is 5 years. So this was, I struggle to figure out what this means for the rest of these defendants. Maybe Bill has a little bit more insights than I do, but it seems to me that this guy was sentenced, I think, so far before we expect the major defendants to be sentenced, that he was working with the feds. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but I think it would suggest that they got to this guy and, you know, got him to talk and build up a case against the bigger defendants in this case. So maybe that's wrong, and this just happened to be the first case that got litigated. But to me, that's what I glean from that. And I Bill said this at the time, that, you know, anybody that's expecting Service and Navarro to go to jail for life, like, that's just not going to happen. But, you know, a couple of years in jail, I think, would be satisfying enough. But the main thing, to me at least, is that none of these people can have any involvement whatsoever with horses or horse racing ever again. And that's the main thing. And I wonder if there's, you know, because there had already been rumors in the past 6 months or so of Jorge Navarro being involved with a training facility in Florida. So I just wonder if, whether or not that's plausible for the legal system to keep these guys out of the industry. I think it's probably not. I think they'll find a way to weasel their way back in. And it's up to the sport to keep them out. And thank God Travis Tigert's coming around the corner, because I think he's going to do a lot better job of that than the people who are currently in charge of the sport. But, you know, there's not going to be these huge, long sentences that these guys most likely deserve. The main thing is to keep them out of the sport. And the guy, you know, in his quote yesterday, Scott Robinson's quote, he was talking about how regretful he was and about how much he loves horse racing. Well, I don't want to hear that, because, you know, this wasn't a one-off thing. This wasn't like, oh, I made a mistake and, you know, I didn't mean to embarrass the sport, blah, blah, blah. You knew what you were doing. You knew that you were harming animals, and you kept on doing it anyway because it made a lot of money for you. So, you know, sayonara, enjoy prison. You fully deserve it. And I hope that that's coming down the line for the other 26 defendants in this case, because, you know, there was really despicable behavior in those indictments. And I'll toss it off to Bill now, because he did write the story and probably has more insight than I do.
Yeah, a couple more insights on top of what you said. I mean, first of all, you know, we're so used to slaps on the wrist for people who do wrong in horse racing and are involved with drugs. And look, this is no slap on the wrist. Someone say, oh, this is a terrible thing. The guy should have gone away for 20 years. 18 months is serious stuff. Spend time in prison. And Joe, I don't agree with you. You said there might be a possibility that someday these people get back into racing. First of all, that would be a just a horrible, horrible decision to ever let them back. I don't think it's going to happen. I really don't. You know, at the end, unless something comes up and these guys are found innocent, but I don't think that's going to happen. And so I think whether it's Scott Robinson, Jorge Navarro, or Jason Service, or anyone else involved, they are not, you know, they can go work at Dairy Queen now. I mean, that's what they have to do with the rest of their lives. And, you know, good luck to them. And when I was working on the story yesterday, I had some of the same thoughts you did. You know, we're trying to read, always trying to read between the lines. What does this mean? And this is how, you know, I talked to two people yesterday, insiders in the know. One said the sentence proved that Robinson definitely is talking, definitely naming names, et cetera. The other person said the sentence proves that Robinson is not cooperating. Took the same part of information and gave me two different stories. And these were people that really should know. Is he cooperating? I don't really know. And, you know, again, as I was calling around yesterday, it's been 1 year and one day now. And I've heard the same thing over and over and over again. Stay tuned. It's going to be soon. There's going to be more indictments. It's not going to be more than maybe a couple of weeks from now. I mean, I would hope that would be the case. I think that would be good for racing and good for continuing to clean up the sport. But I've been hearing that for a year, and it just never happens. And I don't know what to make of it. I'm not going to be one of those guys out there saying, I know what's going on, and they're going to indict trainer X and trainer Y, et cetera. I really don't. We can just sit around and wait for the remainder of it. And the other thing, too, I agree with you, Joe. I mean, I understand, you know, the guy has got to stand up in court and try to say he's sorry and everything. But, yeah, what a bogus apology that was about. You love horse racing, but you drugged horses to the point you made $3.8 million and you didn't care about their welfare and you didn't care about the integrity issue. You don't love horse racing. You love money. That's what you love, Scott Robinson. So good riddance. Get out of here. And, you know, I'll send you a cake with a saw baked in the middle to your new address at the federal penitentiary.
You know, there's an old saying that what does Earl joke, I should say, about what do you call 10,000 lawyers, you know, tied to the bottom of the ocean? A good start. That's what this is. This is a good start because this has some teeth to it. A year and a half in federal penitentiary is not easy. Not that I know that, you know, by experience, but I just can't imagine being, you know, a learned veterinarian in there, you know, in a maximum security prison. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, what he's used to. It's not going to be, you know, what he, you know, the people that he normally associates with. You know, I think that it's good that it's starting. We've heard hints and whispers and even, you know, in interviews that we've done and even with, you know, I was excited when we interviewed Travis Tygart because I felt like that he gets it. He understands what we're trying to accomplish in the industry and how to clean it up. And I think this is a good baseline of, you know, hey, somebody did something wrong. Somebody did and got caught. And these are the consequences. And I think it's enough of a consequence that will make people at least stop and think about what they're doing. Whereas in the past, it was the Wild West. And it was like, why should I bother? Nobody can test for this stuff and I'm not going to get caught. And yeah, it's to the detriment of the athlete. But that's, as you guys mentioned, that's so far in the rearview mirror compared to, you know, the money that they were making that they didn't care. They don't care at all about the athlete and the animal anymore. It all comes down to how much money they could make, you know, off each injection and each therapy. So I'm happy that that this, you know, got prosecuted. I'm happy that it wasn't a slap on the wrist. And I look forward to more indictments coming down the pike, not only because it's going to be good for the show, but because it's going to be great for the sport.
I agree. And I think that's key is that, you know, this got knocked out of the news for a long time because there were so few developments. And I think COVID affected it, affected the court schedule, and it kind of pushed everything back. But I think it's good as a deterrent to keep this in the news and keep hammering these sentences down. I don't know like how frequent they're going to be, but to keep these sentences coming, I think would be a big deal and kind of keep the momentum that we got from the original indictments. And maybe that can run through when Heisa takes into account and Travis Tygart comes to town in mid 2022. So this story came out last week and it was actually a story that we broke originally back in December when we had Aiden Butler, the CEO of the Stronach Group on. It was a great interview, a really good guy to talk to in racing. And he broke the news on this show that they were considering installing a synthetic track at Gulfstream Park to kind of reduce the wear and tear on the turf course. And also to mitigate scratches because they get a ton of scratches when races come off the turf or when there's sloppy tracks. That was officially announced last week that Gulfstream is going to install a Tapeta surface, which will replace the outer half of the turf course. Now, this is a big deal. They would become the first track in America to have three surfaces that they race on. And I think that this is the future, honestly, because I think the reason that synthetic tracks struggled so much to catch on when they first came to be in America was that they replaced dirt surfaces completely. And especially at, you know, historic tracks like Keeneland. And a lot of people were jarred by that. And I think rightfully so, that this is a completely different handicapping experience, first of all. And it screws up the history of the sport when you have horses like Monba winning the Bluegrass, you know, a race that's been won by Hall of Famers throughout its history. I think this is the future. I'm not against synthetic tracks at all. In fact, I've been advocating for Aqueduct to install a synthetic track for the winter so they can keep some of those turf horses that go south in New York, because the purses in New York are fine. Like, you can make more money in New York over the winter than you can in Florida. People just go to Florida because of the weather and because of the prestige of the races that they have. This is the future to me, to have three surfaces that you can run on all three. And I understand that it's not feasible for most tracks. I think there's only a handful of tracks that can afford to do this, first of all, but also have the space on their racetrack to be able to do this. But this is the way to go, I think, because, you know, synthetic tracks in some level are here to stay. And I think it's good because they have been proven to be safer over time than dirt tracks and turf tracks. But also, you save a lot of cards, to Aiden Butler's point, you save a lot of cards and make them still bettable when races come off the turf. And you have the option of running a turf horse on synthetic, which is much closer to dirt. Dirt is a completely different surface than turf, even a sloppy track. People think that sloppy tracks are a little closer to turf. Maybe that's the case. Synthetic is even closer. So I think to have these kind of options, and you could do it like, you know, if for whatever reason you thought the dirt track wasn't safe, or like, you know, it had some questions about it, or, you know, horses were getting hurt, like training over it, then you could switch races to synthetic for a week or so until you had a chance to, you know, examine everything. Maybe Santa Anita could have used that in 2019 instead of being forced to continue to run on this dirt track that they knew was unsafe, to have a synthetic option as well. To me, this is the future. I laud Gulfstream for doing this and being the first ones to try having three surfaces. I think you can't hurt to have more options in terms of surfaces at your track, especially if you're in a place where it rains a lot and you are, you know, constantly in danger of losing races and cards to off the turf action. So I wonder what Bill and John have to say about this.
Yeah, I don't have too much to add to what you said, Joe. And I would also agree with you go back to the point, not a lot of tracks can do this. I mean, Gulfstream had this huge wide turf course that was twice as wide as, say, a turf course at Monmouth or something like that. But I think it's a very good idea. And just from the economics of it, I don't know what it costs to put this in. I'm sure it's in the seven figures, but this will pay for itself over time, obviously, because that 12 horse grass race that comes off the grass is run on the dirt with four horses is going to do terrible in handle. But that 12 horse grass race that is run on synthetic and 10 stay in the race is going to handle so much more than the race is just decimated by coming off the turf. And everybody hates those races. There's nothing worse than an off the turf four horse thing. Somebody's 2-5 and, you know, they're strung out 15 lengths coming across the wire. But the other benefit I think we failed to mention, Joe, was that, remember now, with Calder out of the picture, we're having Gulfstream Park run year round with no break. And everybody's wondering, how can that turf course stand all that and hold up to that? I would think at some point in time, you know, maybe in the dead of the summer or whatever, they're going to tell the horsemen, hey, for you guys with grass horses, we're just going to we got to give the grass a break. We're going to card races on the synthetic. And I think the guys will be fine with that. You know, maybe not great at stakes horses and Chad Brown or something, but the guy with a 20 claimer runs on the grass, can I run him on the synthetic to feed the surface? You know, why not? So I think it'll accomplish that as well, because that's an important thing. You know, they use the heck out of that turf course, and it's got to get a break at some point in time.
Yeah, and this is just, again, swinging the pendulum towards safety, making safety first, making it better for the athletes, better for the people involved, less maintenance. And with that first go around with the synthetic surfaces, I remember talking to trainers and actually running at Keeneland in that first meet. And one of the concerns that they had was that, you know, in Kentucky specifically, they would get a week where it would be freezing cold, and then like the next week it would be 80 degrees. And what was happening is the surface wasn't used to being in that kind of a situation. So it was coming up in clumps, and it was like pelting horses. They would come out of a race, the come from behind horses were coming out of races with welts on their chest from bits of this all surface, you know, synthetic surface coming up. And I think the science of it has gotten much better, you know, over the years. And that's what's making it, you know, much, much safer for the horses involved. And you know, all the points that you guys mentioned before, it's gonna be great to see, you know, safer surfaces and just more opportunity for horses that usually are one dimensional, like the turf horses only, or horses that prefer, you know, a sloppy racetrack or an off racetrack. This is going to give them more of an opportunity to stay in training and stay in training safer. And just as an aside, I know you guys mentioned, you know, Woodbine as having this surface and Turfway and now with Gulfstream. I know that it wasn't highly reported, but the PETA protesters said just how springy and soft the all-weather track was out at Golden Gate when they were lying down and protesting.
All right, we'll get to that. But yeah, I mean, I think this is a great compromise, because I think John's point is good. And, you know, synthetic tracks have developed since they first were put in. Polytrack is no more, basically, in America. That was the first, they were the first to market, and there were some issues with it. And I think Tapeta has, you know, beaten them in the free market as a better surface, as a more consistent surface, maybe a little bit closer to dirt in terms of results. But I think this is a good compromise where, you know, ripping up all the dirt tracks and installing, you know, unproven synthetic was not the answer. You know, getting rid of all synthetic tracks now is not the answer as well. I think this is a good compromise where you have options. Traditional dirt horses can still run on dirt, and we should do everything we can constantly to try to make dirt racing safer. But then we also have synthetic options at some of the bigger racetracks. I think this is, you know, like I said, this is something that most tracks can't do, but for the tracks that do have the real estate and the money to do this, I think this is the way to go going forward. We got the February handle numbers in the past week. Now, the top line item is that wagering in U.S. races in February 2021 was down 6.79% compared to February 2020. So you know, your instinct is to say, well, hold on a second here. Here's the stop to the momentum from the positive handle trends of 2020 and the first month of 2021. But you look at average wagering per race day, $3,835,887 compared to $3,044,840 last year. That's an increase of 25.98% wagering per race day. And I think that is the more pertinent number compared to the top level. What was the total sum bet on horse races? Because I mean, it's an average. It's a little more telling than the total. And I just think that this is, you know, the beyond just the positive handle trends, I think that the trend of less racing and then greater handle and potentially greater field size is the wave of the future in the sport. I am not going to stand here and, you know, say your track has to close down and your track has to close down. But over time, naturally, the sport is going to have fewer racetracks and fewer race days and fewer races, and it's going to be a net positive, I believe. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple things I want to add to that, Joe. So the handle was down 6.79% in February after being up a comparable number in January. And again, we're all trying to answer this question. Is racing growing? Is it a bigger pie? Have we attracted new customers during the pandemic? Just a couple things to note about this to better understand why handle was down in February 2021. First of all, 2020, February is a leap year. So there were 29 days in February last year and only 28 this year. And also, more importantly, there were 5 Saturdays in 2020 February, whereas there was only 4 in 2021. So that goes a long way to explaining why the handle was down. But it looks like it's going to take some time to answer the questions that I've been raising and other people haven't thought of. But I think at the end of the day, we're probably going to learn that racing really didn't grow, and it's pretty much the same amount of money that was always bet. But I hope I'm wrong about that.
I mean, I point to the average per race day. You know, maybe you're right that it's just it's the same money being moved around, but I don't know. I disagree. It's going to be hard to figure out, you know, unless without another year's worth of data probably, but I just disagree. I think that there has been a bump in new customers, and we'll see if that's sustainable. One more story we wanted to get to this week was the news from last Thursday, I believe it was, that when protesters shut down Golden Gate Fields as racing for, you know, four, 5-6 hours or so, they did end up running the card later that night. It was probably around 7:30 West Coast time when they finally kicked it off with the second race. There were only 4 protesters, and they linked their arms with steel beams. I'm sure we're showing the photos of them right now with the smoke, the purple smoke that they threw up around them. You know, a lot of people were really mad about this, and I get it, you know, and they were live streaming, the group that was doing it was live streaming it. And I think the person that was talking about it really didn't know that much about racing. So they were like pretty ignorant about the bare bones of the sport. But at the end of the day, like, this is America. You have a right to protest. Eventually they were removed from the track. They might spend a little, you know, a day or two in jail, but that's about it. Like, you know, at the end of the day, if your sport can't stand up to the scrutiny of public protest, then you don't need to be around. So I think all the people that are whining about this and like yelling at the protesters, like, just get a grip, take a breath. This is going to happen. You know, battle back on the field of data and science. And, you know, these overall, I think racing has done a good job responding to the protests that we've seen in the last couple of years, the PETA protests outside in California or whatever. This was a little bit more disruptive, I would say, because they, you know, stopped the racing car from going on. But at the end of the day, like I said, this is America. You have the right to protest. You know, as misinformed or silly as you think that they may be, you know, just deal with it. Deal with it. You know, stop whining. You know, fight back with information and data and science. That's all you need to do. And eventually they're going to go away.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I think a couple of observations here. First of all, I mean, PETA has always been the bad boy. Everybody goes against them. This group made PETA look like amateurs, you know, so far as PETA's never disrupted a car. PETA's never had guys lay down on the racetrack. Matter of fact, to the best of my knowledge, PETA has never called for the abolition of horse racing. They've just said it's got to become much safer. These guys flat out, we want horse racing to end. And this isn't the last of this. I think there might be copycats. You know, I'm sure security at something like the Kentucky Derby will keep somebody from being able to do this. But I think, you know, the sport's got to brace for this challenge, just like you said, because this is the first of many. And I think these people will have emboldened other people, say, hey, look what they did in Northern California at that race. And, you know, the other thing too, and I think people in horse racing fail to understand or really don't come to grips with, you know, you and I could say they don't know what they're talking about. You know, to PETA's surface, they're protesting at the safest racetrack in the country, Golden Gate Fields. And, you know, the number of breakdowns is down measurably from a couple years ago. And, you know, we're doing everything to clean up the game with the drugs and everything. The man on the street doesn't hear that. They don't know that. They hear, I mean, every TV station in San Francisco covered that thing. So everybody watched on the 6 o'clock news, people standing up and saying, horses die at Golden Gate Fields, and this is terrible. You got to put them out of business. That's all they hear. They don't hear anything else. And it's hard to refute that argument. I mean, they said that three horses have died there over a 4-day period. I assume that's true because nobody said otherwise. And you pound that message home to the public. And, you know, it's tough for racing to combat that. And, you know, again, you can tell them all along. They'll say, we love our horses so much. Yeah, you do. But you know what? People on the outside don't care. They don't care if you feed them carrots and peppermints in the morning. They care that horses die at the racetrack. So, you know, the only thing you can do from this is continue to strive as much as possible to keep the sport safe. And to add one other thing, to anybody who was trying to give Gordon Elliott a pass, this is exactly why what he did was so unbelievably detrimental to the sport. And I know we're prepared to talk about that. Giving him only 6 months was a crime. He should have gotten banned at least 5 years. Because again, in England, you know, all over the news, the tabloids, et cetera, idiot trainer sits on dead horse. Oh my God, what an awful sport that is. That's what the man in the street thinks.
Yeah, I mean, to combat that, you know, the misinformation, I have an idea. Put me on television. Any news station in the world, you want someone for the pro horse racing voice, put me on TV. I'll help you out. But you know, at the end of the day, there are going to be people who don't think that you should race horses for profit. Like, it's just going to be a fact of life going forward. Bill's point is correct that the Gordon Elliott stuff does not help, and the drugging news does not help, unless you come down on these people with, you know, the full force of the, you know, put the fear of God into them every time someone embarrasses the sport in that way. Unless you do that, that you're gonna leave room for this stuff to happen. And at the end of the day, I'm not with the protesters, because you know there's animal welfare is a cause I support, and it's why one of the reasons that I rail every week about getting drug trainers out of the sport. But you know, the meat industry, like the meat processing plants and all the slaughterhouses in the world, like, can we try to shut those down first or clean those up? Like, racing, you know, 99.8% of horses that race in America return safely to their barns. When a horse dies, it's extremely tragic, and we should try to stop it as much as we humanly can. But at the end of the day, it's such the abuse in racing of animals is like this big compared to the greater world and everything that's going on. So I'm not with the protesters, but at the end of the day, they're going to exist. And there are going to be people who don't think that you should race horses for profit and, you know, for just for entertainment. So I think that that racing needs to, you know, kind of grow a pair a little bit and stop crying every time you see some of these people, you know, outside the racetrack or disrupting the races. It's going to happen. You should have the confidence that racing overall treats its animals very well. And they are doing something that they love to do and that they were bred to do. And the animals that aren't, that are being forced and abused to do something that they shouldn't be doing, we're trying our best to get that out of the sport every single day. That's the message. That's the way that you counter this. And until, you know, we get around that unified message, there's just going to be more of this, and we're just going to have to deal with it. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is a special contributor for the Los Angeles Times, does one of the best racing columns in America, John Sherwood. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the hype. I'm not sure I live up to that, but I appreciate it.
No, I mean, you do a great job, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you, because you're one of the last remaining national racing columnists in America. This used to be a regular position at most newspapers, so you must be doing something right. I wanted to ask, because your beat is, first of all, I wanted to ask about California, because your beat is mainly California racing. You write about racing on a national scale, but it's had to have been a very tumultuous time to cover Santa Anita and California racing in the last 2 years. Breakdowns in 2020. I just want to get a general sense from you, as someone whose beat this is, where you think Santa Anita was in 2019 with all the breakdowns, and the progress you think that they've made since then, not just in terms of, you know, between you and I, but in terms of the greater perception of the sport in California.
Well, there's no doubt that 2019 was like an incredible year. I wrote tens of thousands of words on the horse breakdowns at Santa Anita. I mean, the funny thing, I was on the phone with the source when Battle of Midway went down, and that person was at the track, and I'm saying, oh, what, you know? And then we got something up, and then it just mushroomed from there. I think a good comparison is, even though it was this past weekend at Golden Gate, you saw where protesters went on the track over some recent deaths there. Okay, at that point, there were five deaths. you know, one was a sudden death, which, you know, was probably a heart attack. You know, there were only two what we'd call breakdowns. That was five. And at the similar point in 2019 at Santa Anita, there were 20. Just to give you a comparison as to how much has been done. And I think a lot has been done. And it's mostly been through through pre-race evaluations. You know, hopefully none of you watched the Los Alamitos races on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, but you'll see a lot of scratches. And a lot of those are just because of pre-race evaluations, because, you know, that's kind of a cheaper grade of horse than you might see at Santa Anita. So they're doing that. California is an incredibly regulated state, as compared to, say, you know, Florida, which has basically no regulations. So I think the progress has been immense. However, you know, until the number becomes zero, it's never enough. And zero is, in many terms, you know, an unattainable number.
Hey, John, thanks for joining us. This is a treat. Old newspaper man talking to a newspaper man. But what I'd like to add to that or get your opinion on is that in 2019, the public at large was just bombarded with the news, death at Santa Anita, death at Santa Anita, be it the Los Angeles Times, all the TV stations and whatnot. So what do you think the man on the street in Southern California thinks of horse racing? Do people think it's a cruel sport that perhaps doesn't deserve to continue to exist?
You know, I've been asked times why California. And I think that the sensibilities in California are just different. I mean, it's a more animal-friendly place. You know, I would risk my life to save my dog, but that doesn't mean that I think he's my equal. And you know, that it's just sort of an attitude in California that doesn't. You know, in Kentucky, a horse dies and nobody cares. You know, because that's horse racing. But in California, that was the deal. I think that in a crazy way, COVID helped calm things down because there could be no ballot initiative to outlaw horse racing, which was underway. Although I'm not sure they would have reached the critical juncture and then the hundreds of millions of dollars that racing would have thrown at it to defeat it. But I think that, you know, people's sense of being just goes from moment to moment. Right now, horse racing is not in their consciousness because you didn't have five TV stations out at Santa Anita every morning at Clocker's Corner with, you know, with horses training in the background, which you had for, you know, probably 3 to 4 months. And then again, after a Mongolian groom in the Breeders' Cup Classic. So I think that's why California is different and sort of what the average person on the street thinks. I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure they think a lot about horse racing because Southern California, especially Los Angeles, things get swallowed up so quickly. And again, when you're at the headline, they care about you. When you're not the headline, they don't. And right now, racing is not the headline.
John, let's shift gears a little bit to talk about some of the three-year-olds that are entering the Kentucky Derby conversation. You know, we are based in the East Coast, so there's a lot of horses that we cover here with an East Coast bias, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on today. But this year in particular, you know, when we did our Kentucky Derby draft, where we each picked five horses for a contest, it was really West Coast centric, you know, in no particular order, with Hot Rod Charlie and Medina Spirit, Concert Tour, Roman Centurion, Life is Good, Dream Shake, and I'm missing a couple. Is this just a really good group of three-year-olds coming out based on the metrics, or are we just kind of overblowing it because we don't see them up close and personal like you do?
I think that a lot of it has to do with Bob Baffert. I mean, four of the top horses, you know, Medina Spirit, Life is Good, Concert Tour, I believe runs this Saturday, Spielberg, they're all on the trail. You know, Hot Rod Charlie was the O'Neill horse. Dream Shake was the Urton horse that finished third in the San Felipe. California really does seem to have, but I think it's because Baffert gets the best horses. Is Bob's a great trainer? Yes, of course he is, but he's got the best owners. And, you know, when you get a horse like Spielberg for $1 million, that's pretty good. I mean, trying to remember what Life is Good was, what, like a 525 purchase or a 325 purchase, somewhere in there. But, it, you know, it was not a cheap horse. But you know, I think, you know, having essential quality back on the East Coast is, you know, pretty good. I mean, he's, I would think, would be number one on my list. You know, I think it's just another year where Bob has four contenders. He had four last year, although Charlton and Nadal didn't make it. Of course, last year was, you know, like unlike any other year. Talk about the cliche phrase. This year, it's pretty good. Hot Rod Charlie came out of nowhere, you know, to finish second in the, I mean, even Doug, who's under a little duress right now. He's serving, today would be day three of his 10-day suspension, cut from 30, is, you know, and he didn't think that horse would be, you know, second in the juvenile, that sort of thing. So, so, you know, it's the horses we see all the time, but West Coast racing is kind of geared more toward 3-year-olds than others.
I wanted to ask you to put on your media critic hat here, John, for a second, because I think one of the things you do well in your column is that you strike a balance between, you know, not be getting too in the weeds for the horse racing audience, but then also not dumbing it down too much for the broader audience. And I think that's a tough thing to do in racing. What do you think the key is to being able to reach that broader audience, whether it's on TV, whether it's in a newspaper, whether it's online? What do you think that, what can racing do better to reach a broader audience rather than just kind of narrowly focusing on the audience we already have?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I've always felt that there are two sports that you actually kind of need to know something to cover. And one is horse racing and the other is auto racing. Because, you know, they start talking some of that auto racing drafting and, you know, and pistons and all that stuff. And it's tough. I really didn't start. I started covering racing about 4 to 5 years ago. So I had the advantage of kind of learning along with my audience. And I know when I first kind of assumed the beat from Bill Dwyer, people would ask me, well, what do you know about horse racing? And I'd say, well, I know what a Ridgeling is. And, you know, that would be about, you know, so there was some level of knowledge, but not near to the point. I think getting caught up in times and fractions is especially when you have a run up and, you know, timing is sort of in some ways kind of bogus at times, and they're always adjusting it, or getting caught up in buyer figures. You know, the hardcore handicappers like that, but the average person can't relate to it. I think getting a little too deep in the weeds on breeding is something that, again, the hardcores like, but the average person, you know, as we were when we were emailing last night, I said, don't ask me about breeding, because all I'll say is into mischief. Good. You know, but is that that's kind of the extent of my knowledge. And so that's one of the things. And to take that extra minute to just explain something that everybody else knows, but you don't. Actually, one of the things that I did last week was explain what happened at Golden Gate completely dispassionately. I mean, one of the things that you know, this is what happened. These are the horses that died. This is what the animal rights activists, you know, it was a big, frankly, a zero for them, because they had all the headlines were on the fact that they shut down the vaccination site in doing that. So being able to do that, and I, you know, I get hate mail from a lot of the horse racing people because I cover horse deaths and things like that. And I get threats from the animal rights activists because I'm not covering it enough. Matter of fact, I've even gotten death threats from the animal rights people. And frankly, no one is covering that more than I have, not because I want to, but because it is a big story in California, first at Santa Anita, and then, you know, just most recently at Los Alamitos. Golden Gate is, you know, 8 hours away, so I don't really spend a lot of time on that. So that's the balance you try to strike. The fact that, you know, I'm kind of new to this myself means that I'm always doing learning, and I do on a lot of things. I've got like 3 or 4, I'll just call them sources, that I will call all the time to have them explain something to me, just to make sure, or me repeat back what I think I know, and to they'll tell me you're either right or you're wrong.
People out there should understand that John doesn't just write for the LA Times, the printed edition, the online edition. He puts out a newsletter that maybe John at some point, or maybe Patty, we can put up the email address to contact John, because it's very popular and very well done and obviously is free. But John, one thing that you spend a lot of time on, you do these steward rulings, and John will get from the California Horse Racing Board, you know, all the so-and-so smoked in the shed row, fine $50, et cetera. But lately it's been dominated by whip infractions with the jockeys. And, you know, this guy gets a $200 fine. This guy gets a $500 fine. And it doesn't seem to be slowing down either. They're coming in rapid fire succession. How would you sum up the whole situation in Southern California with these very restrictive whipping rules, and seeing how all the jockeys are getting fined for this? You know, what's your opinion on whether or not it's been successful or something that other jurisdictions should look at?
You know, I think it's been very successful on sort of down chart. You don't see a lot of rulings on anything but the first and second. You know, I always try to put in where the horse finished of the jockey that gets dinged. And it's big money. I mean, it's 500, 750, 1,000, and the fourth time in 60 days, it's a 3-day suspension. And some pretty good jocks have gotten that. I mean, Drayden Van Dyke, and I think Hernandez just got one. I'm trying to remember whether Cedillo got one. But I think it's had an effect on the minor placings, where you won't see them really getting after a horse. A lot of times the ruling will be after first or second. And then, you know, an extension of that is, if you have a big race in California, are you better off bringing in someone from the East Coast who basically has, you know, zero strikes, and all they're going to get is a $500 fine? I don't know. And another sort of corollary to that is, why, if this is really so oppressive, why don't the best Southern California jocks go east or to the Midwest or whatever? And, you know, as good as Flavien Prat is, he's still going to be like the seventh or eighth jockey, you know, in Florida. I mean, at Gulfstream or you know, in the good New York or Churchill Downs. So they're kind of stuck here. You know, they say that it's just a popper. You know, does it hurt the horse? I don't know. You know, I don't ride. I don't ever plan to ride. I think it's a visual for the sport. It's a bad visual. I mean, let's go back to Victor Espinosa's ride aboard American Pharoah in the stretch of the Kentucky Derby. He hit the horse 31 times. That's a lot of strikes. And I've asked people about it, and they say, well, if he hadn't done it, he probably wouldn't have won that race. Obviously, we don't know the answer to that question, but it's something to think about. So, if I can go slightly off topic here, one of the things that I think everyone is just completely wrong, you know, there's all this, the Horse Racing Integrity Act, Integrity and Safety Act, that's going to change the sport, the whole thing, it's going to standardize rules across the country. No, it's not going to standardize rules across the country, because states can make the rules tougher, and California will probably make the rules tougher. You know, I don't know. I've always been suspicious of it's and you know, the animal rights people say, oh, this is going to clean up the sport. I don't think so. I mean, the sport is going to have, you know, jurisdictional issues, because they've always had jurisdictional issues.
And John, just to shift back for a second to the most recent race, Derby Prep that went on this weekend at San Felipe. You know, there's a lot to be said about Life is Good's finish. And obviously, you ran a huge number and everything like that. But you're out there. Could you explain to people through your eyes what you saw with Life is Good going wider and wider and wider as he crossed the finish line?
Yeah, what happened, and this is, you know, he's an Into Mischief like Authentic. They describe him the same way, about floating over the ground. And Authentic, remember, had that, I think it was in the Sham, or maybe it was in the San Felipe, I think it was the Sham, you know, where he's just like bounding all over the place. And he's looking, and what happened with Life is Good is he was looking at the scoreboard, at the the video board, which of course we all get to see on the backstretch of every Santa Anita race, because why they can't figure out why we have to look at the scoreboard for 2 to 3 seconds on the shot live shots, you know, it confounds me. So he's a horse that just likes to look around. Bob was saying that in the paddock, you know, he was, you know, saw other horses and he got a little startled. And what that makes me wonder is what happens if when he hits the wall of sound at Churchill Downs. You know, I think there's going to be fans at the Santa Anita Derby. All LA County has to do is go from purple to red, and then on the COVID threat level, and they'll be able to have a limited number of fans. Or, you know, do you put blinkers on them? Obviously, a lot of horses run with earplugs. So that's what he was doing, is he kept looking around, and Mike Smith was saying that, you know, when he did it in the paddock, he says, I sure as hell hope he doesn't do it in the race, but he did. And again, Authentic had some of those same problems. So yeah, that was why it was kind of an odd race down the stretch. Not the first one we've seen like that, but you know, Bob has a way of getting them ready when it matters. And the funny thing, and you know, you guys know Bob too, is when I was talking to him Friday morning, you know, I was asking him about Life is Good, and then he kept going over and talking about Medina Spirit, which to me made, you know, in Bob speak, sometimes that's a horse that he's really thinking about. Well, Medina Spirit ran a great race, finished second, but was not in the class of Life is Good on Saturday, you know, at Santa Anita.
So John, one last question for me, just as a, you know, owner of horses, when we look at different racing jurisdictions, you know, we look at purse structure, number of starters, you know, who else is out there. And really it looks like California racing is ripe for an opportunity for some of us to bring horses out there. In your estimation, what would be a good opportunity, you know, level of a horse, whether it's turf or dirt or sprinters or fillies, or, you know, if you had to recommend somebody on the East Coast or in the Midwest, what kind of horses would do well out here in California? What would you recommend?
Well, California, as you know, is becoming more turf oriented. As a matter of fact, on the average, on the 3-day race meet at Santa Anita, there's 9 races, about 5 of them are going to be on the turf. They do have that new 6.5 a furlong chute, even though there is a dirt crossover early on. I think they'll eventually go back to the downhill for some stakes races. But I think there's a real lack of a lot of good fillies and mares. As a matter of fact, if you looked at the Santa Isabel on Sunday, which was an Oaks points race, there were 4 horses. 3 of them were Baffert and 1 of them was McCarthy. And before the scratch, 2 of them were McCarthy. So, you know, clearly we have a big lack of those kind of races. California is an island. That's the problem. You know, like if you're back on the East Coast and you're in, let's say, New York, you can go to Pennsylvania. You can go to a lot of different areas, to Maryland, and it's just a quick ship. Well, if you're in California, there's no quick ship. You know, you can go 8 hours up to Golden Gate. Arizona's not racing. There's not much you can do. So I think grass horses and fillies. We have a lot of 3-year-olds, older horses. I mean, just, you know, Maxfield came in and lost in the Santa Anita handicap. That was not a great Santa Anita handicap, you know. Because the stock out here wasn't that great. I mean, we had Accelerate a few years ago for an older horse, but I think there are like 1,800 horses at Santa Anita. That's not a lot. Del Mar will have more. So that's, I don't know, that's my guess. And hopefully the dog barking in the background did not overtake the...
Yeah, that's like remarkable focus to stay right. On the answer. I always get thrown off on my dog barking. Thank you so much for coming on. Google John Horse Racing Newsletter, Los Angeles Times Horse Racing Newsletter. We'll put up the link and his email address at the bottom of the screen here. You do a great job. Keep up the good work, John. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you, man.
Great job. Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, John Cherwa, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Before we go, I just wanted to plug this weekend's races. Not a huge, huge day of racing Saturday, but at Oaklawn, we will have the $1 million Rebel Stakes. $1 million still only drew 8 horses. I wonder what that's about. Maybe it's because my monster, Caddo River, is in the race. Drew the rail, so he's going to have to go. No excuses. He's going to have to be put on the lead. So it'll be interesting. I think that'll be a little bit of bigger test for him than he's had so far in his last couple of races. Also, the Azari only has 5 horses on Saturday at Oakland, despite 350,000. But overall, pretty good card quality-wise, if not quantity-wise. Whitmore is going to be back in the Hot Spring Stakes, making his 8-year-old debut tomorrow in the 8th race, I believe, 8th or 9th race at Gulfstream. Prevalence is going to run in a first level allowance going a mile. He drew the outside post, should be 1-9 or close to that in there. So probably going to try to use that as a springboard to the Florida Derby. And then on Saturday in the Beholder Mile, the Grade 1 Beholder Mile, at Santa Anita, not only are we expected to see a friend of the show, West Point's star, Hard Not to Love, I think Swiss Skydiver is supposed to make her 4-year-old debut in that race as well. So that's worth looking out for this weekend. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. A reminder that entries are now open for the March digital sale. You can learn more at keenelanddigital.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, John Cherwa, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Aaliyah LaRocca, Anthony LaRocca, and Danny Seiper. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask and get vaccinated if you can. We'll see you next week.